Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining us today is David Skarica. He's the founder of AddictedToProfits.net. How are you today, David?
I don't know if I should say I'm good, but I'm doing pretty well right now, as well as can be, considering everything that's going on. And the fact that, in the Bahamas, we have the quarantine and house arrests and all that kind of stuff going on. But I guess there's worse places to be.
David, before the call, we were chatting about the leverage that is basically taken down the system. And this was simply the pin that has pricked this bubble. And how do you see how this leverage was set up to fail?
Well, I actually wrote two books in 2014 and early 2016. One was called Collapse, and it was about how the Federal Reserve had built a new stock market bubble. And I'll tell you the reason why I did these in a second. And the other one was called Bear Market Rising. And this was after the initial kind of correction in 2015. And I have to admit, at that time, I thought that was the start. Like this break that just happened now, I thought that break, which was not nearly as bad, but was still 15-20% correction pretty quick off the top in 2015, was the start of a bear market. And the reason being is the Fed used all this cheap money to inflate asset prices. And at that time, the stock market had just gone above 100% to GDP, meaning that the stock market capitalization was bigger than GDP. That's Warren Buffett's favorite indicator. And the only other two times in history that occurred were 1999-2000. And 2007, and in both times, you had to be like 50% bear markets. Well, the market kept going up despite of that to 160% of GDP, an all-time high, even higher than the 2000.com bubble. And then you saw what happened after it did that. That happened in January recently. So I just thought that all these asset prices were totally inflated. And I think the reason that this has happened so viciously is two reasons. Number one, being so inflated, makes the markets very vulnerable to any kind of shock because you're priced for perfection. Another indicator that's almost an all-time high or was an all-time high is price to sales. See, the problems with PDE is the PDE at the market at the top in January wasn't that bad. But it was because the E, for lack of a better term, was BS. It was all stock buybacks, which inflated the earnings per share. So the PDE, the price to earnings ratio, didn't look that bad. But the price to sales, and you can't hide sales. You need growth for sales, right, was at an all-time high. So you have these inflated valuations, which means any kind of shock, boom, you have way more room to the downside. And then number two, part of the bubble was just people having too much debt. People, corporations, governments, name it. Everyone was way too indebted. Like, there's no reason, even if the economy shuts down for a month, that 65% of people in Vancouver shouldn't be able to pay their mortgage for 2 months. Like, that's ridiculous. That means you have no savings. And why do you have no savings? Because the prices are ridiculous. People try to fool themselves with these stupidities, during these bubbles. Like in Vancouver, it's like, oh, there's all this foreign money coming here. Blah, blah, blah. It's a big hotspot. There's limited land, because you got the ocean to the west, the mountains to the north, the U.S. border to the south, and that sort of thing. So it's all just, that's all nonsense. Like, an average house should not cost $2 million, no matter where you live. Maybe Monaco. I could give it to Monaco. Monaco only has 20 or 30,000 people, not millions of people like Vancouver. So people are that leveraged, and then you have some kind of slowdown. They're not ready for it. And it trickles to everything, like Subway and Cheesecake Factory in the United States couldn't pay the rent after 1 month of not having business. These are multi-billion dollar companies. So the whole thing was just totally built on cheap debt. And one of the sectors that I became bearish on in 2014, 2015, when I wrote these books, was the airlines. And part of the reason was I felt the airlines were being priced like growth stocks. And the airline industry is not a growth industry. It is a highly cyclical industry. There's a lot of costs involved. All the companies have a lot of debt. We've seen a million airlines throughout the ages go bankrupt. But what was happening is the airlines in an 11-year period since the 2009 bottom to the top this January, they spent 96% of their cash flow on stock buybacks. So what the airlines, again, were doing was artificially propping up their earnings and stock prices for basically executive compensation. And that was why they were so vulnerable to this. Now, granted, the airlines, again, it's such a low margin business. You get 2 or 3 months where things stop, and it happened 9/11 as well. Most of them, a lot of them will go under. For example, the airline bailout was $50 billion. And that amount, that 96% I talked about, was $45 billion. So you could argue that if the airlines had done no buybacks, they would have had that $50 billion to sit back on. And that's kind of what the whole economy's done. Everyone's borrowed, everyone's leveraged. These low interest rates that were promoted by the Fed after the financial crisis kind of entranced everybody to borrow. And people thought there was no consequences, but now we're seeing that there are. And I really just think this was going to happen anyhow. It just took a pandemic to kind of prick that bubble and kind of expose the economy for what it was. And it wasn't the quote unquote greatest economy ever. It was economy like that was built on quicksand and debt.
I was reading a stat today that for every $100 of income, the average Canadian has $176 of debt. And I can't imagine that the U.S. is in any better shape than that.
Well, there's another stat that I think 13% of a Canadian's income goes towards like debt payments on their house. And that's easily the highest in the G7. I think the U.S. is like 8. Canada is probably one of the worst prepared countries for this because of the indebtedness.
So as we're talking about house prices, how do you think they're going to fare going forward, considering that we're likely not going to have a quick restart after things get quote unquote back to normal?
Well, here's the issue that no one's thinking about is like what drove these house prices in Canada? Okay, there were low interest rates and people unable to borrow cheaply. And that happened in 2000 in the States. But Canada is a much smaller country than the States. You only have 37 million people. The States has, you know, over 350 million. Well, so what happened in Canada was, you know, you get a small amount of Chinese money or Middle Eastern money coming in there. That really inflates the prices of the market because, you know, that top 1 or 2% of the market goes up and then everything kind of goes up behind it. Well, no one's talking about, okay, a lot of the Canadian market, there's a guy, a great short seller named Mark Dohodes. He's talked about this at length. A lot of that money that, you know, was Chinese money laundering, it was money laundering, by the way, too. It was illegal money coming in. And what happened was, is governments all turned a blind eye because higher house prices meant higher property tax revenues and more money for the government. So they turned a blind eye to all of that. So here's what no one's talking about, that Chinese money coming in, is that in the early 90s, when the Japanese bubble burst, is that a lot of the Japanese became net sellers of North American real estate. And so Toronto had a bust, New York had a bust, because the Japanese that were thought they were rich and weren't rich anymore had to sell that stuff and bring the money back home. And I think one of the reactions to this whole thing going on, and by the way, this isn't like a lashing out me personally against the Chinese. This is just what I think is going to happen, is I think you're going to see supply chains move, and logistically it kind of makes sense, even if, you know, even if you're pro-China, you can't have all your production there. So when that happens, the Chinese aren't going to be as rich as they thought. And then that means a lot of these rich Chinese who own the factories that may be empty now or you know, had a business in Macau dependent on full casinos, which won't be full anymore, they will have to then in turn sell Canadian real estate to bring money back home. And no one is talking about that in Canada, right? Everyone just thought, oh, the foreign money will always come in. So I think if you get that combined with the indebted consumer in Canada and, you know, people being underwater on their mortgages, high unemployment, I don't know. I'm pretty bearish on Canadian real estate. And the problem in Canada, too, is, and you're in Alberta, you know, one of the places that actually has another industry outside of housing, is that when they kind of shunned the oil and gas sector in Canada, the whole economy became the housing bubble. So when that kind of goes away, you're going to have some serious problems in the Canadian housing market, mostly in Toronto and Vancouver. You know, Montreal started getting hot near the end, but it's still pretty reasonably priced there. So I don't think it'll be as bad off there. I think Vancouver, for example, what's going to happen there is what happened in the U.S. bubble, where prices are going to fall 50 to 70%.
Absolutely. And with Western Canadian Select, a barrel of that hitting less than $5 today, I don't think there's much of an oil patch left, never mind the housing industry either.
That industry just has to kind of stay on life support, because I think the one thing that could help that industry is that I'm more bearish on the fracking industry in the U.S. because that industry is really built on cheap money and debt. And those wells have much shorter life spans than the oil sands. So they're probably going to go broke before the Canadian oil sands do. And then when you finally do get a pickup in the economy, or remember, all we need is the economy still not going to be good, but just coming off, we're at zero right now, right? So if you go to zero to 10 or 20 and have a kind of a crappy economy instead of an awful economy, you are going to see a pickup in demand for oil. I think that will help the oil sands, because what's happening in the oil sands, you know better than me because you work there, but a lot of the companies are just kind of, they've cranked down production, and because they have such long, you know, lifespans, they can crank it back up. Where the problem with these fracking companies is, okay, you've got a well, it lasts for 2 years, you drill the rest out of that, and you can't borrow any more money to drill a new one that lasts for 2 years. And Jim Chanos, who's a very famous short seller and a guy I respect a lot, he's always made the comment, the fracking industry isn't a business model, it's a financing scheme. So it's all about to keep borrowing cheap money and keep drilling these uneconomic wells. So I think actually right now you should be selectively looking at things in the oil sands, because to go one step further, when those frackers go under, the U.S. is going to need a source of friendly oil, you know, not Russia, not Saudi Arabia. So I think that could actually help. And that's kind of a contrarian, maybe pessimism, a maximum pessimism view. But I actually think there's more opportunities in the oil sands. And also, I think this is going to force the Canadian government to be more friendly towards them, just because there's not going to be much more industry left or much of an economy left with the housing bubble burst. So they're almost going to be forced to help the oil sands. And even just so you know, the Toronto Star, of all things, wrote an article like promoting the oil sands for that reason. So when you get the Toronto Star doing that, it probably means the sentiment towards the oil sands as kind of like, you know, a strong part of the Canadian economy is going to change.
Well, I'm sure there's lots of people in this end of the country that have their fingers crossed on that. I remember the last time oil really took a big hit here, most of the big companies, it seemed that they just kind of figured out how to run and be profitable again at those prices and run a little bit leaner instead of so fat the way they were.
Yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. Actually, and one thing that benefits Canada, even though some of the larger producers have debt, is the way we operate as Canadians, as you know this, in the mining industry and oil and gas industry, is we tend to operate with equity. So we'll do private placements, and where the U.S. tends to operate with debt. And I think that actually helps you in these busts, because, okay, you have to dilute your shares, but you can stay, you know, you can stay alive. Or if you have debt, you just can't, you know, you just kind of can't pay it back and you default.
So how do we see this playing forward for gold and silver, David?
Gold and silver are interesting because, look, there's two kind of people who have these opposite extremist views. Some people are just deflationary. And they think, oh, everything's going to collapse and be like the 30s and prices are going to go down and, you know, there's going to be no demand for anything. And then some people are hyperinflationists where they think, oh, they're just going to print tons of money and it's going to be the Weimar Republic. And I'm kind of in the middle. I think that some things will, in the short, especially short to intermediate term, be very deflationary. Like in 6 months' time, you're going to see a huge amount of auto inventory hit the market, for example. Well, that means like if you want to buy a car with cash, if you have cash, you're going to get one really cheap in like 6 to 9 months. And then, of course, the housing we talked about, because there's tons of supply there and people that won't be able to pay their mortgages or be underwater. So that will become cheap. But on the other hand, they are going to print money. They're going to do everything they can to get out of this inflationary scenario, which, by the way, they didn't do in the 30s. So that, to me, makes it different. So what I see is short-term deflation, everything going down, but then the reaction being so extreme, we'll see some kind of stagflation or hyperinflation. And when you talk hyperinflation, it doesn't have to be Venezuela. It doesn't have to be the Weimar Republic or Argentina. Hyperinflation is just anything over 20-30%. Because remember, if your prices are going up about 35% a year, they double every 2 years. So I think we're going to see that kind of thing. And the government, by the way, will underreport it. So they'll do that. So they, you know, because everything's indexed to inflation, it will be 30 and they'll say it's 6. Yeah. Yeah. So then they don't have to. And that's how, by the way, and people will see, you know, say it's 30% inflation. They'll be like, hey, the stock market went up 15. Well, you actually lost 15, buddy. You know, so so in terms of gold and silver, in the deflationary phase, I think gold is going to outperform, or, you know, they'll be on par. But once you get into that hyperinflationary phase, silver is so cheap compared to gold right now, it will probably begin to outperform. And actually, from the really simple investment standpoint, silver tends to attract retail investors. And I think as gold and silver continue to move higher, that's another reason silver will outperform, because a lot of the retail people will just go into silver just because it's more affordable, more cheap.
A little more attainable, almost like an altcoin versus Bitcoin.
Yeah, Bitcoin. And by the way, in terms of technically, you look at gold, it looks fantastic. Like, you've had this huge base that formed for like 6 years. Yeah, and by the way, you're totally right about that altcoin Bitcoin thing, because when the Bitcoin mania got going, I remember like people who knew nothing about investing were telling me about Litecoin and, you know, Dogecoin and all these weird things that at the time I thought was weird. We're talking about like college students with no money, right? And that will probably be the same type of people that get into silver, which will push the silver price higher. But just a last note to get back to the economy for a second. So there's three kind of people, I think, right now. And you have to like, I think you want to be the first kind, which is someone who's realistic, knows, okay, this is a really bad bust, and it's probably in the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. But there will be opportunities. You will be able to buy companies and industries that will turn around. Precious metals will do well. You have to, like, in terms of your own job, if you're lucky, like someone myself who works online and actually somewhat benefits from this, that's great. But also, if you were someone in the service sector, you got to kind of reinvent yourself and find opportunities. There's always opportunities somewhere, even in a bad economy. And just kind of like be realistic about the situation, but also try to remain positive and, you know, find a way to kind of make money out of it, or like survive or the whatnot. Then the second kind of person is someone who's just the doom and gloom type, or in terms of the virus, you know, people who are freaking out, think it's the end of the world, they think they're going to die. And that's not healthy too. You know, that's very negative as well. And then the third type is, and I think this is actually where the majority of people fall into right now, and actually don't like talking to these people, talked about this off air, is the V bottom types, who thinks everything's going to come back. Like, oh, this is all because of the virus. People will just go right back to work and everything be normal again. And that's not going to happen, because this is like the Great Depression, in that people's spending habits are going to change. The views towards money and work are going to change. And you have to be cognizant of that. So if you're one of those people, and a lot of those people are just doing it because they almost want to believe in that, because if, like I said, if you're one of these people who bought a house in Toronto for $1.5 or $2 million, and, you know, realistically that house is going to go down, you know, 30% in price overnight, you want to believe it's going to come right back. So it's like you're just being delusional because it fits your narrative. And I think you have to be realistic about that, and not, you know, buy into that kind of, you know, delusion. You just have to be realistic about the situation. And if you, when you're seeing that the unemployment's going to 25-30%, you're seeing these mass multi-trillion dollar bailouts, you have to be realistic and just think to yourself, this is not going to be the same coming out of this. And I think one of the issues with the quarantine that we're going through now is people are just sitting around at home, you know, watching Netflix, watching YouTube. You know, I'm doing that too, to a certain degree. And it's like, you're not really seeing it happen. You know, it's not like in 1930 or 1931, you saw people losing their jobs. You'd walk around the street and the people were at soup kitchens. And we have seen some of those lineups, you know, and pictures of them, you know, for people at bread lines or you know, food banks or the whatnot. But it's like, you're at home most of the time now. And I think it's almost like being in a bomb shelter when a nuke goes off, and then 6 months later, you're going to get out of that bomb shelter when the economy, you know, is open, a little more open, you can go around. And it's like, wow, this is totally different. People aren't spending money. A lot of these shops are closed. If people are in the shops, there's a lot less people. They're spending a lot less money, et cetera.
Absolutely. And everybody seems to be kind of sitting at home, not spending any money, hopefully living off of a tiny bit of savings that they do have at this point.
Yeah. And it's just like, and what I think actually the thing, again, where spending habits will change, is that people are going to do that and forget the fact that, okay, they may lose their job, they may not have a lot of money, but they'll also say, like, hey, that really wasn't that bad. You know, I didn't need to go to a high-end steakhouse every week. I didn't need to, you know, max out my credit card on clothes every week. Right. So I think that's also why it was change spending habits, in that when people do that and their lives weren't significantly worse, maybe other than some boredom because they couldn't go out, they're going to like really change. And then we talked about this out there too. Another problem is, How are you going to go to a casino? How are you going to go to a sports game? There's going to be all these measures for like testing and people waiting for vaccines, and people, a lot of people psychologically are going to be scarred because they're not going to be scared. They're going to be scared to go out in large groups. Someone blows their nose, they're going to freak out, you know, stuff like that. So there's all these other different reasons why the economy could change as well, because it's not just monetary. When you go through something like this, like Howard Hughes, the famous billionaire, one reason he became a germaphobe is that there was a cholera epidemic in Houston where he grew up in 1913, and his mom put him in quarantine, and that kind of made him a germaphobe. You know, obviously he ended up becoming a billionaire, but it also, like, psychologically in the end ruined his life. So there's going to be all these kind of other things as well. It's like, it's almost like having shell shock, you know, when you're in a war, like every time someone hears a bang, you know, like you maybe was in the war, kind of freaks out. So it's like, it's not as extreme as that, but it's like, yeah, people are just going to be, a lot of people won't be able to handle this psychologically as well, especially when you lose your job. A lot of people are going to go to drugs and booze and that kind of thing. So there's all these other factors that people aren't really considering when they just think that everything is going to kind of come back. Like for a perfect example is I saw a company I think is going bankrupt is Dave and Buster's, or like Chuck E. Cheese's, like those kind of things. Because who after this is going to want their kids rolling around and stuff, all sweaty with a bunch of other kids, you know, like, you know, like, I just don't think that's, you know, on top of those places being expensive to go to, who that, like, that's a model. It's got to be totally dead.
Have you been at all surprised by any of Trump's reactions to any of the stimulus packages or anything that we've seen out of him?
Because Trump is, I really don't think he believes in anything. Like, he's not a conservative, right? He ran for the Republicans because that was more, you know, Obama had just finished. I guess he could have said he could run for the Democrats because Obama was finished, right? And but, you know, he was going to run against Hillary. So he probably saw, number one, the Republicans is a much easier field because Hillary was like a political monster. So in terms of, you know, her, you know, family name and her husband as president. So he probably looked at that Republican field, was like, this is a joke. Right. I know Bush was there, but Jeb is kind of lightweight. So he and then he wasn't, you know, he ran on the kind of like protectionism. And if you go look what he said, he wasn't like the neocon kind of nouveau Republican. The thing about him is he's a big government guy. They were running huge deficits even before this. He was spending a ton on the military. So I think personally, he kind of wants to be the right wing or the Republican FDR. He wants to bail everybody out, right? He wants to do infrastructure projects. He may be the one that introduces universal income, you know, funded by printing of money. It doesn't really surprise me because I don't think he believes in anything. You know, he's kind of someone who just goes with the flow and wants to be right in the moment. That doesn't surprise me at all. And like I said, they had a $1 trillion deficit even before this happened. So he's definitely not a fiscal conservative. That doesn't surprise me at all. Okay, he cut corporate taxes, but they borrowed the money to cut them. You know, it wasn't like it was some great conservative move. No, that doesn't surprise me at all. And I think the only thing he's going to have to do is a lot of those bailouts are seen as, you know, kind of being bailouts for the rich, you know, the airlines, Boeing, you know, businesses getting loans. So I think in the next phase, he's going to have to do infrastructure or maybe add on to that $1,200 one-time payment and make it maybe a monthly payment for a few months, because he's going to have to look like he's bailing out the little guy as well.
Well, it doesn't look like he has much opposition in November.
That's one of the issues, too, is that, like, look who he's running again. The interesting thing about politics is how much is timing, right? Like, Trump in 2016 was perfect because people were angry still about the financial crisis. Even though the stock market was going up a lot, people didn't really think the economy was really good. There was kind of like this populist mood, and he was like the perfect guy for the time. Well, if this pandemic had happened a month or two earlier, probably Bernie and Andrew Yang would have had serious a chance of winning. Because Yang, because he's a proponent of this kind of universal basic income, and his argument would have been, hey, if everyone was making $1,000 a month, that would have been a cushion against this. And then Bernie, because of it, you know, like the federal government's going to cover people now if they get sick, you know, because of COVID, and, you know, can't pay those bills. So that's kind of a form of, you know, socialistic universal medicine. That's the kind of interesting thing about it, right? In the end, is that if this would happen like a month or two earlier, before they kind of bailed on Bernie and then basically gave the nomination to Biden, those guys would have had a chance. And the issue with Biden is, you know, politically, he's not much different from Trump. He's more of a centrist. They're going to try to move him to the left for the election. And look, I don't even care about Biden's politics because I just think remember at the end of his second term, Reagan had Alzheimer's, like the early stages. I just think Biden is mentally not there at all. And I think he's crazy. I think he's nuts. I think he's lost it. So and when you get into debates, that's where you're really going to see it. Mentally, he's, you know, got serious issues. He's got some kind of psychological issue going on where, you know, he's in the 70s and he's probably not all there. He's probably got some form of Alzheimer's or, you know, that, and that's going to show itself in debates in the White House. And if there's one thing this election is going to be about, it's about kind of a reactionary tone towards China, getting supply chains out of China, you know, and Hunter Biden. Yeah, he's totally in with the Chinese. So that is going to be a huge, huge factor in all of this, because I always tell people, you know, all those tariffs Trump was talking about. If you ask the average person now, would you care if Trump put 1,000% tariffs on stuff that came from China after this? I think most people would say, no, I wouldn't. You know, I really wouldn't care. I don't care about my iPhone. They should do that. They should produce that in the States anyhow. Get all those companies out of there. I think that the majority of people wouldn't care anymore.
Absolutely. It's interesting to kind of look back on what we were focused on, say, 3 or 4 months ago.
Well, now you see, and certain stuff like politically, like the impeachment was a joke, right? Now no one even cares about that. Yeah, and if you look at the impeachment, like the real joke about that was going on when this started, you know, when the coronavirus started spreading in China and they were focused on that and everyone was focused on that instead of what was the real kind of threat.
All right, David, any concluding thoughts as we wrap up?
Oh, yeah, yes. You're always going to find opportunities, and not just gold and silver. Like one thing we talked about off the air is, you know, I am still long this company called Abbott Labs. And, you know, they have this testing COVID. And then they also have another test to see if like you've ever had it before. Right. And these are the kind of tests people are going to have to take before they go back into the workforce or go to sports games or travel, et cetera. You'll probably have some app on your phone that says whatever you've had it, you're immune, or it's going to be complex to see if you are immune, if you ever had it. So it's not that easy. But, you know, that's the first step. And then or if you do have it now, et cetera, like to go back to work. I could see because the device that they had to test it and a positive came back in 5 minutes, a negative came back in 13 minutes. But it's more the apparatus. It's like the size of a toaster oven and you can take it around and it's a portable test. It's not like some big thing that looks like a computer that IBM built in the 1960s. Right. So I saw this and I was like, wow, that thing is really going to, you know, they're going to sell a lot of those. They're going to do a lot of tests. And then it's obvious that they were coming up with other tests as well. And that stock today just broke out to a new all-time high. And we also had call options on it. My subscribers are doing quite well. So it's like you can find these kind of opportunities. Or I didn't really want to buy Netflix because it was so expensive. But Netflix has gone to new highs because, you know, everyone's sitting around streaming videos. So there's these kind of things you can look at and see what's going to benefit from this. What people have to realize is, even though things are pretty negative, there's always opportunity. You're always going to find opportunity, you know, out there.
Some small words of encouragement, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that's the way you have to view these things. Or I said, like those three types of people, if you become too negative, you're just going to drive yourself insane and go crazy.
If anybody has any questions or comments, please email me at tom@palisaderadio.com. David, thanks for your time today.
Oh, thanks.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?